Thank you for downloading the Saturday Review podcast. For more details about our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. Hello. Britain's oldest museum is also its newest this week, as the Ashmolean reopens after a £60 million rethink. Also, Philip Roth's new novel, The Humbling, his 10th since he turned 60. But will that title have a double meaning? And Channel 4's new drama, Misfits, in which a freak bolt of lightning gives five teenagers on a community payback scheme an unusual new set of life skills.
Something really weird is happening. I'm hearing these voices in my head. It's like I can hear what people are thinking.
Oh, have you been sniffing glue?
The storm, the lightning, I don't know, it's just done something to us.
Okay, if you can hear our thoughts, what am I thinking now?
This is bullshit.
You think it's bullshit?
Of course I think it's bullshit. You don't need to be a mind reader to know that.
You don't, but as it happens, Kelly is telling the truth, and she and her friends have to make the awkward transition from Asbo to hero. With me to review all those and to discuss whether the phrase adult puppet show can ever be anything other than an oxymoron are the writers Philip Hoare and Liz Jensen and the director of the ICA, Echo Eschen. We start, though, with supernatural powers which take a bit more effort to acquire in the film The Men Who Stare at Goats. John Ronson's book of that name was a work of non-fiction, though it wasn't always easy to credit that fact, since it described a secret Pentagon project to develop psychic powers as a military tool, a project overseen by one Major General Albert Stubblebine III. Stubblebine was real, as were the attempts to see whether goats could be killed by a sufficiently concentrated nasty look. But for Grant Heslov's film version of the book, a fictional frame has been added, with Ewan McGregor playing an investigative reporter in Iraq who happens across an American contractor with an unusual backstory.
You were there for hours. What colour were the chairs?
Green.
Beige. How many lights are in this room? A super soldier wouldn't have to look. He would just know.
Super soldier?
A Jedi warrior. He'd know where all the lights were. He could walk through a room. He could tell you how many power outlets there were. People are walking around with their eyes closed. At level one, we were trained to instantly absorb all details.
What's a Jedi warrior?
You're looking at one.
You are a Jedi warrior.
That's correct.
I don't know what that means.
I'm Sergeant First Class Lynn Cassidy, Special Forces, retired. In the 80s, I was trained at Fort Bragg under a secret initiative, codenamed Project Jedi. The objective of the project was to create super soldiers. Soldiers with superpowers. We were the first generation of the New Earth Army.
George Clooney as Lynn Cassidy and Ewan McGregor as an American journalist who obviously isn't a Star Wars fan. Philip Hoare, now you're going to be redacted from this discussion due to injury. Basically, you injured yourself so badly you couldn't make it to the cinema. Fortunately, you made it here. I think the people in the film would say the universe itself was trying to prevent you from commenting. Liz Jensen, I'm going to have to come to you first instead. Ronson first worked on this material for a documentary, and it was a three-part documentary, very detailed. You could assume that he hadn't made anything up. Here, you don't know which is fiction and what isn't. Does that cause a problem, do you think?
Well, it does a little bit, I think, because it was a brilliant book as well. It wasn't just documentaries. It was a very funny and very clever and very well-researched book, which I read and admired a lot. And that's why I was looking forward enormously to this film. But I did feel there was a little bit of a problem in that we weren't told exactly how much of it was true. And I think we really needed to know, because there's some quite alarming things going on at the edges of this film to do with torture, which is what a lot of this psychops business was all about, or what it led to, what that is referred to in the film as the dark side. So I felt there was a fuzziness around that, which I had a problem with. That said, they had to impose a narrative on it. They had to put a story on it. And I think the story they came up with was very good, and there were some fantastic performances from the four main characters. And there were lots of laughs. There weren't belly laughs, but there were sniggers and there were slapstick moments. And it was all much more benign than I thought it might be.
That maybe is part of the problem. I mean, this project had its origin in the kind of counterculture in the 70s, didn't it, in the late 60s. And it was a Vietnam vet who said, we've got to kind of, you know, try and use love as a weapon of war to disarm our enemies. Now, this ends in a much blacker and darker place, doesn't it? Echo Eschen.
Exactly. It does, within the bounds even of this film,
And that's quite uncomfortable. As Liz says, you know, a lot of this kind of territory ends up in, you know, very dark psychological experiments, or experiments basically in torture. And there's a passage right at the very end of this film where we see some figures in orange jumpsuits being tortured, and we see what are supposed to be some of the consequences of these actions that have taken place all the way through the film. And this is actually where the film should be at its strongest, but in fact is at its weakest, because all the way through what happens is we tread this, I think, quite uncomfortable line between satire and fantasy, between satirizing events that were real and between creating a slightly fabulous fantasy of things that might have been real. So we're never actually allowed, or we're never actually presented with a straight choice between is this really fact? Can these people really do some of these things? Or are we supposed to just laugh along with them and sort of enjoy the whole process? And this really falls apart towards the end, because we see some of the consequences of this action and the film doesn't know what to do with it. The film tried to play it quite lightly, so you have this almost comedic moment where you have people who are released after torture and they're supposed to be set free in a kind of the comic high point of the film, and it falls apart desperately there, and actually it turns into something that's not even non-comedic, but it's something that's desperately, I think, poor taste, potentially morally compromised.
Yes, I mean, it is an awkward moment, and there's nothing to be done with it really, because it seems to be as flippant about Abu Ghraib and such things as it is about this kind of mad enterprise.
Yes, I completely agree with Echo here. I think there is a moment in the film where you suddenly start to feel deeply uncomfortable. Mm. And this issue of taste rears its head, and you think, oh, I shouldn't be laughing at this. These are people in Guantanamo-style orange jumpsuits who have been tortured and who some people on LSD are releasing from their torture
they all,
chamber.
They all notably have good trips on LSD as well, which yeah. seems a bit of a...
And actually, I didn't think it was funny. I thought a lot of the film was very funny up until then, but then
there's
I
a moment earlier in the film where you
it.
Think, oh, it'll work to transfer it to Iraq. You know, it'll somehow work to transfer it to the insanities of that. They're bowling along through the desert, and it's a complicated plot, but he's trying to rescue somebody. He leans out of the window and says, you know, don't worry, we're Americans. We're here to help, and promptly runs him over with the car, you know. And
basically, this is the kind of terrain that, you know, that Joseph Heller has mined successfully, that Slaughterhouse-5 tries to cover. But with both of those books, you have to be absolutely unsparing in the gaze that you bring to bear. You have to recognise the absurdity of the situation, and the comedy comes out fundamentally of the tragedy of those times.
But Catch-22 is very different, isn't it? Because the victims are, as it were, your own forces. Mm. It's not the infliction of tragedy on somebody else. Here, you've got other people being tortured, problem for a satire even to cope with.
Yes, and that's what happens at the end. But all the way through it, there's an uncomfortable line, and I don't think the film and the director really knows which way to go. Because, again, you know, we have this thing where we're not quite sure whether to laugh with or whether to laugh at George Clooney and his cohorts. We don't know.
A lot of people in the cinema where I watched it did laugh at him, because he's actually got a very kind of dry, funny presence for the earlier sections of this film. It seems to me he's a great comic actor in some ways,
yes,
just
absolutely.
By doing very little.
Yeah, I think it's worth saying that the performances were absolutely stunning. George Clooney in particular, I thought, and Jeff Bridges, who does a marvellous character of Django. He's called Django.
He's the man
but the
who's
But the thing is, they're so much invested in them as characters, and actually they do so well at embodying those roles, that you actually want them to have these powers. And there is a suggestion somehow that they are so highly trained that, you know, that they can disarm a whole group of men with rifles, you know.
I would have been very dismayed if they'd even remotely. I thought they never gave until, I mean, I won't spoil
well,
the
exactly.
ending, but, you know, there is a bit of a cop-out.
There is a wonderful moment when Jeff Bridges is given back the eagle feather that he awarded to Lynn Cassidy. And at that point, Django says, it's a fake. And you think, what, do you mean the whole thing? You mean the whole thing's a fake? And there's this fantastic pause. And then he says, the eagle feather's a fake. It's a turkey feather. I dipped it in ink because it's actually it's a federal offence to kill an eagle.
No, good moments throughout it, but doesn't quite gel in the end. OK, The Men Who Stare at Goats is on General Release Certificate 15. When a London gardener called John Tredescant started collecting curiosities and exotic specimens in the early 1600s, he couldn't have known that he was laying the foundation of one of Britain's great public museums of antiquity. And that's partly because Tredescant's collection, known as the Ark, helped to invent the very idea of the public museum. One regular visitor was an antiquary called Elias Ashmole, who produced the first catalogue of the Ark's contents and was rewarded by Tredescant's son with a gift of the whole collection. In turn, Ashmole signed it over to Oxford University, and since then, like an accumulating snowball, it has gathered in other collections and gifts, very rapidly outgrowing the 1845 building which was designed to house it. Now, after a £60 million overhaul and the addition of a new extension by the architect Rick Mather, it's doubled its display space and completely rethought the way in which the collections are organised. The old rigid curatorial divisions have made way for a display which highlights the trade connections between different cultures and aesthetic connections across time, which are embodied in Mather's new building by a design which allows you to look from one gallery space into the next. Philip Hoare, we looked round as the place was still buzzing with builders and curators kind of putting on labels and filling the cases. What did you think of the space, first of all, that they've got now?
I think it's wonderful. I think they've done this marvellous thing of turning the building inside out and then back in on itself. And I think the sort of the modern extension to the Ashmolean is very unobtrusive because you don't see it from the outside.
They weren't allowed to show it from the outside. They had to kind of put it in a space where it wouldn't show above the roof line.
Absolutely. So the genteel burghers of Oxford have not been disturbed. You know, they're the threats to the National Gallery, the carbuncles, and indeed the V&A extension, which was stymied. So you have something which is entirely internal in a way. And that's what's exciting, because you walk through this neoclassical entrance and into this wonderful minimalist building, which is wonderfully detailed, in the Portland stone, this wonderful ziggurat of a stairway which sort of takes you up to the very top of the building. And it completely throws open the collection to the air and the light. So you can see around the objects. So things suddenly become 3D rather than that very sort of 2D effect that museums often have. It brings brings the whole collection to life in a wonderful way.
Liz Jensen, I mentioned just before that there are these constant little portholes through into the next gallery, through into a different era, through into a different kind of set of objects, which I liked very much. It led you on all the time to go to the next room.
Yes, I love that. You can escape at any time. I think the architect himself said that that's important too in a museum. But I think, as Philip said, there is this wonderful feeling of space and light. I remember the Ashmolean as a child. I remember it how it was before, because we used to spend the most dreary Sunday afternoons going round there, trudging round, and it was a dismal, dismal experience. It was dark, it was gloomy, it was unwelcoming, it was boring. And now it's all the opposite, and it's such a joy to walk in there, and I just wish I could be a child again and enter it now and really enjoy those fantastic artefacts as they're displayed now.
Echo Eschen, I mean, to my shame, I'd never visited the Ashmolean before. I don't know how that had happened, but I hadn't. And I had no idea of the kind of richness of the collection. They've got astonishing things in there.
I mean, I'd never been there either. It's a fascinating museum, because it describes itself as a museum of art and archaeology, which is an insane amount of breadth to try and cover inside one space. So, yeah, you get moments of antiquity, you get little oddments like the lantern that Guy Fawkes was carrying as he was on his way to...
That was one of Tredescant's own very early acquisitions, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And you come across these things, but then actually, you know, you end up on the top floor and you're looking at Dutch old masters and paintings from the Renaissance. So there's a huge amount of stuff that's been covered. But I think what's most successful here, as in fact has been said, is this is the real answer on show here to museum fatigue. So the thing that we all get when you walk into a space where you go through 1, 2, 3 rooms inside a gallery and actually you start to fall apart because actually the linearity of the space is such that it starts to collapse in upon you. So that's the first thing that's very clever here. The second thing is how they've mixed up the collection. I think they have a tagline for it. Something like crossing cultures, crossing times. And this thing where you can look into other rooms and look into other moments in history, I think is really important. It's really important for any public museum right now to think about how they understand and how they show the history of culture, the history of civilization, not just as a Western linear phase that starts in Egypt or Rome and goes on for that, but actually as a set of time and a set of propositions that speak to each other across the globe and across time. That's what they managed to do very, very successfully here.
I mean, they've literally got that with some two-sided glass cases where, as it were, you know, part of the collection is on one side of the case and another part on another.
Exactly. It's actually a bit similar to when Tate Modern opened in 2000 and they did this revolutionary thing of not telling the story of modern art in one line. You mix it up.
Now, and we should say this method has now become a kind of new orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. And there are people who are resistant to it because they say that scholarship, as it were, the old scholarly certainties slightly disappear in favour of something else. I mean, you don't share that view.
No, absolutely not. And I think, you know, unlike the British Museum, where you walk in, you're bombarded with Grecian pots, you know, you have a definite sense of a mixed-up narrative, you know, the sort of thing that the recently departed Claude Levi-Strauss would be proud of, I think. Because I do, because I think it tells a story in an entirely unlinear way, because that's the way things develop. Yeah,
exactly.
That's the way culture
develops.
Exactly
that. Exactly.
And that's fascinating to see that. And solid objects and tropes, you know, from early English to Chinese to Asian.
They haven't entirely lost the eccentricity, which I think was always a quality of the museum, because, I mean, you come out at one point and there's a huge porcelain collection. Part of the stipulation of which was it must all be displayed simultaneously. So you suddenly pass through a kind of time lock into this very, you know, antique display of just lots and lots and lots of stuff. But even that is kind of quite enchanting, I think, after you've been through the other
sections.
And
by the way, did you know that in one of those porcelain pots are the ashes of the collector? I bet you didn't know that.
Well, I was told that. I went round with Christopher Brown, who's the director.
But going back to what Philip was saying, I think that was one of the huge successes of it, is that there is a sense in which history is in flux still. Mm. You got the feeling that there were still questions being asked, that perhaps some of the collectors of the old days were wrong, and there are all sorts of different interpretations. There was an openness, a kind of questioning feel, which I thought was very fresh.
I think you've absolutely put your finger on it. I think one of the obligations almost of public spaces right now is to think about how they have a conversation with their public. And that means you can't set up a place and say, look, we know all the answers. This is how it is. In fact, you actually have to leave space for that institution itself to ask questions and for the audience that walks through that to be able to ask questions back. And in that respect, this is actually a very human scale of museum, because it allows you to have this very natural, open, easy relationship with the things that you encounter inside it.
As you were saying, very often the public question is, where's the exit? I don't think that it'll be the one that's asked here. The Ashmolean is now open to the public 6 days a week, closed on Mondays. Later on Saturday Review, as Sesame Street celebrates its 40th anniversary, we look at puppetry aimed at the more mature audience with Green Ginger's Rust, and a series squarely aimed at the under-20s, Channel 4's Misfits. First, though, a very different generational demographic. In recent years, Philip Roth has chronicled the indignities and regrets of old age with a vigour that seems to deny age altogether. But his latest protagonist is, by Roth's standards, comparatively youthful. Simon Axler is a mere 65-year-old. But as the novel begins, he's worried by a significant loss of powers. Axler is an actor, one of America's greats, but his talent has abandoned him, and a recent attempt at Shakespeare has ended in fiasco.
His Macbeth was ludicrous, and everyone who saw it said as much, and so did many who hadn't seen it. "Nope, they don't even have to have been there," he said, "to insult you." The worst of it was that he saw through his breakdown the same way he could see through his acting. The suffering was excruciating, and yet he doubted that it was genuine, which made it even worse. He could not convince himself he was mad any more than he had been able to convince himself or anyone else he was Prospero or Macbeth. He was an artificial madman, too. The only role available to him was the role of playing someone else.
Unfortunately, Axler can't even play that convincingly, and he ends up for a time in a mental hospital. He's saved, he thinks, by a meeting with the daughter of two old friends, a woman called Pegeen, whose relationships have previously all been with women. but who suspends her sexual preferences for an affair with Axler. Echo Eschen, like Woody Allen, Philip Roth seems to have immense faith in the sexual magnetism of the older man. Were you able to credit it too?
Well, the book's really in two halves. The first part, as we heard from that passage, is about this very swift collapse of this old man. And actually, I thought that was good in as much as it retains Roth's strengths for character, for description. Does it very, very quickly, and I like that. It just gets into the story. The second half is a disaster. The second half, we're embarked on this affair where he seduces and is seduced also in turn by this slightly glamorous but ultimately dangerous and predatory woman who's had until then affairs with other women and is too dangerous and too hot really for him to handle and leads him into disaster. Seemed curious to me at best.
Well, leave that speaking word there. Liz Jensen, curious?
I'm so unhappy about the way Philip Roth's career is going. I've read too many of his recent books in which there is some old aging Lothario who, fired up with Viagra or fantasy or whatever, seduces some much younger woman who, for some unbelievable reason, is interested in him. And what's more, in this story, it's not only Peggy who wants to hurl herself into bed with him, it's some 28-year-old who they find drunk and who they seduce, and then there's this phantasmagoric episode.
I mean, I hear your pain. I would just like to say that some of his greatest works that you could describe as a Viagra novel. Human Stain is a novel about an older man rediscovering sexual potency with the help of Viagra, and it's a terrific novel.
Yes, it's
so
about
it isn't
many
just
other
that,
things.
Is it? It's something else is happening. Philip Hall.
Well, the whole thing is so histrionic. I mean, he's such a drama queen.
And he is an actor.
I know, pass the six rocket. I mean, and also this thing, you know, some retooling lesbians. I mean, you know, this, the sex in it, I had to put the book down. I felt physically soiled by it.
Now, just to calibrate this, is this a problem you've... I mean, Roth has always been explicitly sexual, so is it a problem you've had with his writing of sex scenes
it's a problem I have with a straight man having fantasies about, you know, converting, inverted commas, lesbians.
It is very explicit about that. He takes this woman on. She's an academic. He starts buying all of her clothes. He feminizes her in a very conspicuous way.
One of the things, you know, the character's supposed to be 65 in here, but actually these read like the fantasies of a character of a man who's much older than that, because the strangeness that's ascribed to this woman who sleeps with other women, the strangeness that the fantasy, the impossibility of it, is so extreme that it feels like a pre-war approach.
You might say that it feels like the fantasies of a 76-year-old.
Well, indeed, it has
a direct comparison to a Noel Coward play, Present Laughter, which is an ageing Lothario actor, completely enthralled to his own sexual potency, you know,
exactly.
Or diminishing.
And that's the difference between late Roth and early Roth. That, as you say, Roth was always priapic, but when he's Nathan Zuckerman, when he's in his 30s or something, actually he can play that for laughs, and he can play
just
with a lightness of touch.
Devil's advocate again. It seems to me that there is there's a rather brilliant short story here, which has been distended by a kind of sexual passage in the middle. And the brilliant short story is about suicide and how one might approach it those bits of the book, it seems to me, are exceptionally good. Yeah. His account of the sudden loss of authenticity and that idea of yourself as an actor, not being able to act your own life, I thought was very moving. Yeah.
There
as
is another little sub-story going on there, because when he's in the mental hospital, he meets a woman who is in there because she's so traumatised by the fact that when she came home from shopping one day, she found her husband in a sex act with their 9-year-old daughter. Later on, this same woman kills that husband. Once she's out of the mental hospital, she kills the husband. But even this I didn't find plausible, because, first of all, that the reaction of this woman would be, instead of going straight to the police and reporting her husband, she instead takes herself away from the child in danger and has a breakdown, and then takes herself away from the child again by killing the husband and ending up in prison. I didn't believe any of that. And so there was a problem on many levels. It wasn't just this.
Well, I wonder whether there was a tiny bit of self-reference in the opening line of this. You know, he'd lost his magic. It's clearly it's a Prospero reference. Yeah. He's playing Prospero at the beginning. But you do wonder whether Roth himself has
the same. I'm sure he can regain it. if he just gets off this horrible track.
I think you're right. I think there are elements of this that are very strong, but sadly, it's too much like Late Updike as well, which is this retreat from actually facing difficult emotions, difficult experiences, a retreat into fantasy, and invariably this very phallic sexual fantasy always. So with both characters, you have. You always have these kind of passages where young women are worshipping the male member and kind of holding it and looking at it and gazing up at it in rapture. Quiet,
I mean, I just say when we're running out of time, but as it were, he pricks the fantasy himself.
Yeah, but is that an excuse for what goes on beforehand? It's not really, is it?
Okay, well, Philip Roth's The Humbling is published by Jonathan Cape. One of Roth's earlier novels, Sabbath Theatre, featured a puppeteer of decidedly adult tastes. His puppet workshop being put into forcible retirement by a combination of arthritis and the puppeteer's unmasking as a degenerate. There's been nothing quite so shocking in this week's Suspense Festival of Puppetry at the Pleasance Theatre in Islington. But in contradiction to the received idea, all this work has been programmed for adults to prove, as the festival programme put it, that puppets aren't just for kids. This week we saw one of the festival highlights, a piece by a company called Green Ginger, probably better known to a wider audience for their widely acclaimed collaboration with Welsh National Opera on a production of Tchaikovsky's Queen of Spades. Their piece Rust, dedicated to the memory of John Peel, seems to be about the insurrectionary power of pop music, and it features a war of the airwaves between a ruthless capitalist with a taste for broadcast homilies and a pirate radio station housed in a submarine, the home for the Limpet Brothers, a pair of conjoined twins with a taste for punk rock. Eventually, though, the Limpet Brothers discover the downside of broadcasting from underwater.
This is Mutant FM.
Signing off.
For the very last time.
Linseed! The water that is surrounding us
is not caused by our sad tears of farewell.
But by the sea rushing in.
Through a flipping big hole.
In our wounded side.
Linseed!
I'd like to say thanks to all our listeners.
And our non-listeners.
Who didn't listen in for whatever reason.
Maybe they were too busy.
Or maybe they had no radio.
Or maybe they had no ears.
Jimmy and Mickey Limpet, played by the puppeteers Chris Pirie and Vic Llewellyn. Liz Jensen, as we walked into this together, we established that we had a perfectly balancing set of prejudices. My heart sinks whenever I see a puppet on stage. Yours lifts, you said to me.
Oh, I love puppets. I've always loved puppets. And the scarier, the better. And these, there was something quite scary about these puppets. They looked fantastic, I thought. They were made of some kind of latex covered and then painted. They were slightly Muppety. And they were so busy. They were so active. You could see the puppeteers on the stage with them, which was fantastic. They didn't bother hiding their faces. They wore flat caps and dark clothes, but otherwise you saw them. So they were doing the voices. They were articulating the puppets. And I thought it was stunning. You have to have, I think, to enjoy this, you have to have a very childish and vulgar sense of humour. Unfortunately, I do, so I adored it.
But that just slightly calls into question the idea that it's a production for adults, doesn't it?
I thought it would have been perfect for teenagers, actually.
I think my 9-year-old nephew would have turned his nose up at it. I think the complete lack of any good writing there completely let it down. Wonderful sets, wonderful soundscape. You know, the puppets themselves, as you say, Liz, were wonderful. The fantasy about it, the whimsy about it was great. You know, the little ship going across the top of the stage. All those things, but completely let down by the lack of anyone walking in and saying, this story doesn't work. It doesn't engage you.
You'd have to know what the story was to begin with. I mean, I made a stab at synopsising it, but I couldn't really work out what was going on. And there seemed to be completely arbitrary, you know, inventions. It really was as though a set of doodles had cohered into a drama, wasn't it?
There was no editing going on with it. You know, I mean, I agree with Philip in as much as actually the setup for it, I thought was fantastic. You know, it sets itself up as something fantastical, as something you have to enter rather than, and it makes little compromise in that, conjoined twin DJs, for instance. But after that, you can't give way just to indulgence, because actually every scene that happened took place for too long. The script sort of meandered off in itself. There were these weird interludes where the puppeteers would come out from behind their puppets and sort of dance around on stage for a little bit and wave their bellies around just for its own sake.
Well, it was a kind of lot of comedy of bearing the device, wasn't there? But I mean, some of that, it seemed to me, worked. The submarine, when you see it, as it were, from the outside, not from an interior shot, is an old copper boiler, you know, on a...
But to what end? To what end those interludes?
No, well, I would agree with you, except that the end of, you know, delight in itself is not kind of, you know, a terrible
thing. The problem was it was too delighted in itself.
It was too pleased with itself.
But I think we have to think about, you know, some of the influences there. I mean, there's obviously the very heavy influence of Terry Gilliam and Monty Python. There's the Muppets, the steampunk, the spitting image, this Marvel comic.
But you raised the Muppets. The Muppets had the most terrific scripts.
I'll agree entirely, I will concede it's celebrating its
40th anniversary.
The story could have been more coherent and could have been stronger, but it didn't completely spoil it for me. It didn't spoil it for me at all, actually, because I was so enjoying these little vignettes. I was so enjoying the power of the characters and the puppets themselves. I'll go back to that because there were some extraordinary visual images there. There was a woman whose arm had been sliced off by a knife in a circus act. She was a fantastically powerful puppet. I mean, they were stimulating.
There were some sweet moments. I think about that, you know, they're two teenage lead puppets and, you know, the whole thing is about their slightly thwarted love affair and they finally get together at the end. And there's a great moment where actually they kind of kiss in this kind of porthole and everything seems fine. It would have been fantastic if the play had finished there. But actually, they tagged on another 15 minutes or so afterwards. Absolutely. Just of stuff.
It was just stuff. It was arbitrary. To be honest, I think it would have been great if you were stoned or drunk.
Well,
and that is the kind of student audience that I think it was aimed at. And I think it was
It's had huge success sort of internationally. So there clearly is an audience.
Well, I think in a smaller auditorium it would work better because I found from the midsection of the back, sort of the you were too distant to see the detail. Because when you went up close to the set, you could see the joy of the detail. And it was difficult to see in a way that...
Yes, I must say the audience the night I was there absolutely loved it. They were clearly enjoying themselves hugely. I did have a problem with the sound, though. If we're talking technically, I found it wasn't very well mixed, so that sometimes you couldn't actually hear what they were saying because the music was so loud.
I think you're perfectly right to talk about the Muppets, talk about any other instances of adult puppeteering. The issue is whether you can retain a quality of dark magic throughout. Yeah. That's what they aimed for. That's what they didn't get to. Yeah.
Right, well, Rusk continues at Islington's Pleasance Theatre until Sunday, the 15th of November. Finally this week, what you might call the live-action puppetry of teenage television. Channel 4 has pretty much made the running in the field of youth programming, with series such as Hollyoaks, Skins and The Inbetweeners delivering the kind of television teenagers do want to watch, but preferably when their parents aren't in the room. Misfits is aiming at the same target audience, a new E4 series which offers a knowingly downbeat response to high-gloss American fantasy fiction like Heroes. Howard Overman's drama begins with a group of surly teenagers assembling to do their community service, supervised by a disenchanted probation worker who looks as if he's been in the job just a little too long. As they work, a freak storm blows up and a bolt of lightning hits the group, leaving them alive but oddly changed. The first to notice that something's up is Kelly, who realises that she can hear the inner thoughts of those around her, unfortunately rarely flattering to her self-esteem. And then the probation worker's irritation tips over into something far more dangerous.
What do you mean a probation worker attacked you?
This does sound like complete shit.
He is out there and he chased me!
Something's happened to me too.
Did you pop your cherry? Oh, we're all very happy for you.
Earlier on when we were in the locker room, I was invisible. I turned invisible.
So she's psychic and you can turn invisible? That seems likely.
Yeah. Did anyone witness this miraculous disappearance?
You were all there.
I think we might have noticed you vanishing into thin air.
You didn't. I was standing right there. You couldn't see me.
All right. Go on, then. Do it. Turn invisible. Oh, my God! He's disappeared!
Robert Sheehan as Nathan, Ewan Rian as Simon, Antonia Thomas as Alicia and Lauren Socha as Kelly. The twist here is that the superpowers are all linked to the teenager's problems. Kelly is hypersensitive about what other people are thinking about her, so she gets to hear their thoughts for real, while Simon, a shy social outcast, finds that he really does become invisible at moments of crisis. The other twist is that their superpowers control them, rather than the other way round. Philip Hoare, I don't know whether you still have an inner teenager, but if so, did it respond to this?
It certainly did. I really loved it. I thought it was a beautiful piece of ensemble playing. I thought the setting itself was wonderful, this grim, apocalyptic, washed-out inner city, the very washed-out colours of the filming itself. But they're great. Each character I really warmed to. I thought there was some wonderful playing there. This disgraced black runner, you know, who'd been caught with a wrap of coke, you know. The very annoyingly chirpy, smart Alec Irish boy who comes out with all these one-liners. And the star is Lauren Soker, I think, as the chavish Kelly, who, as you say, is, you know, can hear what people are saying in her head.
She hates the word chav, by the way, indeed, which gets slung at her all the time. She's got an Essex facelift, hasn't she? Her hair scraped back,
absolutely,
which is the subject of
that. And
absolutely,
she overhears the other girl saying, "Go on, scrape it up a bit more."
I know.
She overhears her thoughts, and that's the first, so the first time she realises that she's got this special power. Mm. I actually watched it with a 15-year-old, my son, whose verdict was, in teenage speak, that it was totally sick, which is a high accolade, as anyone with teenagers will know. I thought it was stunning. I thought it was so alive and cleverly thought through. Because, of course, it's a completely ridiculous situation, but you believed in it right from the beginning. And it's interesting because there was that very difficult mix of comedy and tragedy, because there is a tragedy. Their probation officer ends up being killed, and they end up having to bury him along with the other body.
Well, I was going to say it is totally sick in another. It's totally sick in a sense that a kind of 65-year-old might enter the room and say, "This is totally sick."
Yes, and then burying
which
him.
Is, of course, and, lends itself to a sort of teenage audience. But what did you think, Ekosha?
Seemed to be less enthusiastic than everyone else here. In as much as I thought it strained the boundaries of credulity, not because of the fact that they had superpowers by the end of the drama, but because actually they were so improbably good looking and so improbably articulate that they seemed to be not real teenagers.
One doesn't want to be invidious. They're not all incredibly good looking.
Most of them were, and they seemed to me to be young people, teenagers, playing teenagers. And it's a bit like we were talking about Philip Roth earlier, and it's that sense of, I had this absolute sense of remove. I couldn't see them as embodying their characters. All I could see were, you know, some quite good-looking people playing
these roles. They were archetypes, weren't they, though?
Well, yeah, but there's a thin line between archetype and stereotype, you know, and I think this trod uncomfortably for me on the other side.
I think it's
of
always
that.
Tricky when you've got a group of young actors, but I did feel about this, you know, things. A new series can go wrong very quickly. Mm. It can ditch itself in the first episode.
Yeah.
This, it seemed to me, didn't. It said, there's something interesting going on here, and it could go in a very, very interesting direction.
That I'll agree with. It's tough, you know, you watch one episode, and certainly I'd watch it again. Mm. I'd watch it again because hopefully once you get past the origin episode, you can those characters can start to bed in. It has to be said that it did take this slightly weird twist at the end when the two murders, they're burying a bunch of bodies for no apparent reason.
It's like The Shining or something like that. It becomes very sort of, and John Carpenter as well. But what we're looking forward to, I think, is the backstory of these characters, which is very interesting.
But it's also, one of the characters is a young girl who, you know, she knows she's very attractive. She clearly uses sex all the time to get what she wants. And her superpower is to convert people into kind of raging beasts of sexual desire. But I think that's the interesting thing about it. It's a handicap that she's been given, an incredible kind of potent handicap, and she's got to work out how to sort of work her way around that. I think that's a much more interesting idea.
And I really like the superpower of the sort of the indie nerd who looks rather like Ian Curtis and does this sort of shaking of his head where he becomes invisible. I think he's a great character. I really like him.
And I loved Nathan, whose superpower hasn't yet emerged, and maybe he hasn't got one, and he feels he's the smart talker, he's the smooth talker, and he's furious that he at his superpowerlessness, and we're intrigued about what's going to happen. I mean, I'm definitely going to watch it again.
I have to say, I laughed several times too. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's, you know, the scene where they're burying the two dead bodies, which is clearly going to cause them some problems. You know, I think the social services will notice that. He says, Nathan says, "I'm pretty sure this breaches the terms of my ASBO." Yes. As he piles the last sort of spade of soil onto them.
I mean, the thing is, it is quite pleasurable as a series, and it takes pleasure in that way. I mean, even the clip we played there where, you know, he's trying to turn, he turns invisible, and they say, "I'm sure we'd have noticed if you turned invisible." You know, that stuff is very clever. It's a little, I still think though, and I hope one of the things that emerges is that we get some more grit in there, because actually, as Liz is saying, the interesting part is the backstory. The interesting part is the fact that they're all carrying around this very teenage but very real level of discomfort and social unease.
I live a very sheltered life, but it did seem to me there was some grit. I mean, the writer said, "Some of the rudest phrases I put in the dialogue are things I've heard people say walking down the street." And he says, "There's one particular phrase I've been waiting for 4 or 5 years.
I know what it was.
It made me blanch when I heard it, and I couldn't possibly quote it."
Well, no, we couldn't indeed. I mean, there's some wonderful one-liners which are sort of overheard, you know, so these sort of sitting on the bus conversations which you overhear now. I mean, if you stand outside of school nowadays, the conversations you hear
are unbelievable. But you know what, though? But it feels that the writer spent so much time trying to cram these into there that actually he's spent less time on working out what to do with the plot. So actually, it takes a long time within this for anything very much to happen. And again, that is one of the things of having a first episode. You have to set things up.
Yeah.
And like I said, what I do hope is that we see beneath the surface of these characters, beyond the wit, beyond the banter, to actually what properly motivates them. And as Tom's saying, those superpowers are a proper indication of some of the things that lie inside them. But I think that's the potential real strength of this.
It is a comedy after all.
Yes. I don't know whether Channel 4 should be worried, but barring your son, there seems to be an inverse ratio between the age of the critic and the approval of the programme. The Misfits begins on Thursday evening on E4 at 10 o'clock. And that's it for this week. My thanks to my guests, Philip Hoare, Echo Eschen and Liz Jensen. Next week, full-size actors in a version of Tolstoy's novella The Kreutzer Sonata, Michael Haneke's Palme d'Or winning film The White Ribbon, and another new museum, Nottingham Contemporary, opens its doors with a David Hockney retrospective. A bigger splash or just a ripple?